I didn't even realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a back seat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Moro Casino. America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Welcome back to this Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark. I'm joined, as always, by the award-winning Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I am dandy.
I'm so happy to be talking about movies with friends, although maybe not this movie.
First up in controversies and non-troversies, after languishing on the shelf for 2 years following a Sundance debut that had awards hounds buzzing about Jonathan Majors' performance as Killian Maddox, great name, the movie Magazine Dreams saw its theatrical debut this weekend to a pretty anemic $700,000 or so on 815 screens. It's less than $1,000 per screen, and spoiler alert, that's bad. You want more than $1,000 per screen. The reason the film was shelved, of course, was that after its debut, Majors was arrested for assault. He stood trial. Eventually, he was convicted on two of the lesser charges he was facing while being acquitted of the more serious charges of assault and aggravated harassment. He was sentenced to a domestic violence intervention program and probation. And this movie, Magazine Dreams, was a casualty of all this, with the producers having to pay back Searchlight's purchase fee. Which I did not realize until I was reading the Wall Street Journal story that we're going to reference here in a second. But they had to pay Searchlight's purchase fee back to them because the acquisition came with a morals clause. The film sat on a shelf for a while before Briarcliff Entertainment swooped in. Briarcliff's honcho, Tom Martinberg, has made a career of buying what he describes as distressed assets on the cheap and trying to make money with them, right? So he stepped in to release Dogma and Fahrenheit 9/11 after Disney told the Weinstein brothers that they could not release those films under a Disney label, Miramax at the time being owned by Disney. More recently, Briarcliff stepped in to distribute The Apprentice, the movie starring Jeremy Strong and Sebastian Stan as Roy Cohn and Donald Trump, respectively, after that movie failed to secure domestic distribution following threats of lawsuits from Donald Trump and his allies and worries over backlash from the MAGA faithful. Now, look, I want to make it clear that there's an obvious difference between stepping in to distribute a film that has been stifled by fears of political backlash, right, or religious outrage, and a movie that was dropped because of its star, who in this case, in the case of Magazine Dreams, actually plays a roided outrage case prone to fits of violence, which is probably not the best look for somebody who's, you know, on trial for aggravated assault. That's a different kind of toxic distressed asset, right? But I do think it's an interesting business model, and I think it's one worth at the very least appreciating, if not celebrating outright. Ortenberg is totally right, I think, when he says, when he told the Wall Street Journal, quote, "The creative community is supposed to be bolder than this. We're supposed to take chances," end quote. And Hollywood is absolutely running scared, both from threats issued by Donald Trump and his political allies and worries about what the Trump administration's vendettas will do to potential mergers and that sort of thing, And also from, I mean, look, Hollywood is also scared of the activist left and the activist right, but the activist left, because they live with the activist left. They're worried about mean tweets. We can joke all we want about mean tweets. Nobody wants mean tweets sent their way. I never get any because I'm beloved on Twitter, but that's a different cons and non segment. Again, these two things, not equivalently bad, but they are both bad. And it is good to have somebody in Hollywood kind of pushing back against them. Whether or not this is a winning financial strategy is a little harder to say, right? So I look, Fahrenheit 9/11 was a huge hit. And Dogma did pretty well for a Kevin Smith movie. But the Apprentice died at theaters, just absolutely died. Nobody went to go see it. And Magazine Dreams also died. Nobody went to go see this movie. Their strategy of targeting the African American community didn't pan out. Obviously, you know, folks in the indie film community weren't that interested in it. We'll see what happens when it hits VOD. Maybe that's when folks will start showing up for it. But as of now, I think we can say that this did not really work. It's hard to open a movie in the best of circumstances. And this is obviously not the best of circumstances. You can say that we're going to rely on the outrage to generate news and get publicity and awareness, but obviously in this case, it didn't work. Peter, what do you make of this business model? The idea of controversial movies being a distressed asset that can be picked up on the cheap and potentially serve as a profitable source of revenue for a studio.
It's interesting. So as a business model, though, I think it's hard to know how to think about this when we don't have the purchase price, because we know how much Magazine Dreams was made for. It cost about $10 million to produce. It's a relatively low-budget film. But we don't know what the distributor paid for it as a distressed asset. It was probably more than $50 and less than $10 million. Somewhere in that range, right? But, like, is this number $50,000? Is it $250,000? Is it $8 million? I have no idea, right?
The Wall Street Journal actually does address this.
Sorry, I must have missed that.
Yeah, there's a bit towards the end where Ortenberg says they basically spend a couple million bucks to distribute it and market it to see what we have on our hands, quote. But I believe they did not like really pay anything for the movie itself. So according to the Wall Street Journal, Briarcliff paid nothing upfront for the rights to release Magazine Dreams in the U.S., according to people in the deal. Instead, the company committed to covering the costs of a significant theatrical release and marketing.
Okay, so that's still it sounds like a couple of million dollars here, which is probably not the right strategy with this. Like this is just like as a business matter, the part of this strategy that I don't understand is the theatrical release. And the reason I don't understand the theatrical release is that this is a difficult movie to market theatrically in any circumstance. The way that this was originally supposed to have made money was that it was going to be awards bait, and it was going to be sort of critically acclaimed, like end of year, kind of like Oscars, Golden Globe. Like this was going to rack up the awards type situation when it was in 2023. Obviously, that didn't happen. But one of the things we know right now, we know from the most recent Oscars and just looking at like the last year of box office, is that even when these movies do win awards, that doesn't always translate into a big box office bump. I think that even in the best case scenario, this movie comes out, there's no, in the normal, you know, normal situation that it was supposed to come out in, there's no controversy about it. There's no star drama, there's no arrest, nothing like that. In fact, it's just universally hailed, nominated for Best Picture, probably doesn't win, but like gets maybe even an acting award, that sort of thing, right? Like that was the best case scenario for this movie. And I think even in that case, it probably wouldn't have done that well at the box office. Maybe it would have made its money back. Maybe it would have made a small profit. But this was not going to be a big movie under any circumstances. And so thinking that you can make back several million dollars with an 800 screen release, that's not a giant release for people who don't understand, but that is relatively wide. It means that most people who live near a major metro area in North America are probably going to have an opportunity to see this, even if it's not playing, even if there's not a large number of screenings, right? Like that just seems very odd to me. And like, I'm struggling to imagine a world in which that kind of bet pays off theatrically. What makes a lot more sense to me, and what I think, what where I think that if there's something I want to praise about this, or say like something good about this, is that this movie seems like the kind of thing that could generate interest, that could generate like, actually, maybe I want to see that now on VOD. Seeing this streaming at home, this is the kind of movie that is, that people are going to look and say, well, I did hear it was a good movie, or I heard that this was like something that got canceled, right? Like the canceled movie strategy just doesn't seem like it's a butts and seats strategy. It doesn't seem like it's one that's going to get people out of their houses unless that movie becomes a political cause, unless going to see it becomes an act of defiance, resistance, of like a statement about yourself, like the equivalent of RTing some, you know, of retweeting some like awesome burn on a person that you hate, right? Like a thing that is like, I'm demonstrating that I'm the kind of person who goes to see that kind of movie. And it wasn't marketed that way. It frankly was barely marketed at all. I mean, I guess they spent a couple of million dollars on the distribution, but I found out that this movie was coming out in theaters by hearing from my wife talking about the Wall Street Journal article that you reference. I did not know. I get like the releases from the local studio reps. Like, I'm somebody who pays a lot more attention to this than most normal people, than most moviegoers. And I had no idea this was actually coming out until the Wall Street Journal wrote an article that caught the eye of my wife. And she was like, do you know about this? I was like, oh, yeah, I know about this movie, but I didn't know that it was actually coming out.
So this is really interesting to me, because this is, you are actually an example of their strategy working, right? The strategy on a movie like this is, we are not going to spend a lot of money on paid advertising. We are going to try to earn earned media by highlighting this movie has been canceled. Here, Jonathan Majors is coming back. And so you didn't see it. You didn't see it because they were working with a studio rep, because they weren't. You didn't see it because you saw an advertisement for the movie, because they weren't really advertising it that much.
Also, nobody sees movie advertisements anymore.
As we discussed on last week's episode, on last week's bonus episode, but you did hear about it because there was a story in the newspaper that highlighted the controversy. So, like, this is really interesting to me, because you were an example of their strategy working in terms of creating awareness, but not in terms of I assume you didn't go see it.
I did not go see it. If it had been playing at the local Alamo, you know, 20 minutes walk from my house, there's a small chance, but I'm busy, and it's not something that we have to see for the show, and it's not something I'm going to end up writing about again, unless it becomes a kind of a cause movie that like needs some sort of, creates an opportunity for me to weigh in. It is the kind of thing that I'm quite interested in seeing on VOD. And I think that that's the place where, if this movie gets seen and becomes, it's not going to become a hit, but becomes sort of, has developed some sort of minor cult following, that's where that's going to happen. And I know that VOD revenues now can kind of support, they can be non-trivial. They tend not to be gigantic, but they can be enough to sort of cover a small investment sometimes. So maybe this ends up working out for the company, but I don't understand the theatrical release part of this, especially the 800 screens. I'm trying to think of off the top of my head, like a comp for that. But there's so many movies that people have heard of that like are things that like sort of move through the system that get much smaller releases like this. That's just way too wide for a film like this.
Alyssa, one entry question here for you, because I do think there's a negative polarization model for this sort of thing. And you saw it work successfully in the case of The Daily Wire and Matt Walsh's Am I Racist, right? Like, here's the documentary the libs don't want you to see. Come see this. This movie, and that was the highest grossing documentary of 2024. This is a fairly regular thing on the right. Dinesh D'Souza has done it a couple times. It happens. It is, but this is a harder movie to sell that way.
Well, it's worked pretty well with right-leaning documentaries and sort of a smaller number of explicitly values-driven features. And this is not an explicitly values-driven feature, right? It's like Taxi Driver, but for, bodybuilding. But before I get to...
Well, now I really want to see...
Yeah. For the record, I was the one who's like, we should see Magazine Dreams instead of Snow White. And I was ignored, and that's okay. I'll get
No, on. You weren't ignored. We just made the rational case that more people will see Snow White. Turns out we were right.
Yes, but still, you made us sit through Snow White. All I'm saying is that is not my fault. It is interesting that you mentioned sort of the unconventional release strategy, because I think I may have been more aware of the coming release of this movie because I read a certain amount of celebrity gossip, and Jonathan Majors and Megan Good got like married quietly right before the movie came out and like sort of rolled that out. Like his relationship with Megan Good, who was in sort of a bunch of like movies aimed at sort of teen girls of my age when she was also a teen girl of my age or a little bit older, you know, they started dating before he went on trial. And yeah, like they got married. I don't know if it was like deliberately, you know, sort of part of a larger comeback strategy that included a profile in The Hollywood Reporter. And because I read a certain amount of celebrity gossip, like not a ton, but like I check in. I sort of knew, you know, sort of was keeping an eye on all of this and kind of knew that the movie was coming out. And again, like that can be sort of a strategy. But to the larger point, though, like, look, I think it's good that someone is trying to build a business on, you know, distressed movie assets, right? Not every movie deserves distribution. Not every movie that like hits a bump in the road, you know, like is going to find a wide audience. But every movie has, even like really small productions, have a lot of people working on them. And it can be a real bummer when a whole group of people has put a lot of work into a collective artistic endeavor, and then one person screws that up. And one person screws that up on a piece of art that, you know, maybe really should be seen. I have not yet seen Magazine Dreams yet. You know, I would like to see it at some point. Maybe when the schedule gets slower this spring, we can do that.
Yeah, no, I see what you're saying. I mean, this movie, I think in particular, I think the Wall Street Journal said there was 100 people who worked on it, right? 100 people work on it. And that's not nothing.
Yeah.
Movies, the business, the show business is not a charity where we got to give everybody a participation trophy. Like, I'm glad you made a movie. You know, sometimes it doesn't work out. At the same time, I have always been of the opinion that people are too quick to throw something in the trash over, again, something that is actually, I think, pretty controversial, like Jonathan Majors, you know, going to trial for assault and you know, again, being convicted on a couple charges, acquitted on others. That's a little different than what happened with The Apprentice. But I also do think that, like, you had all these people who were like, this is one of the great movies of the year. This is one of the great performances of the last decade. Jonathan Majors is an enormous star. And now it's just kind of being tossed in the trash like, we're not going to bother with this. And, like, the movie's good or it isn't. His performance is good or it isn't. I don't think we have to. It is annoying to me that there is a urge to pretend that it doesn't exist. So what do we think? Is it a controversy or a non-controversy that Briarcliff picked up Magazine Dreams following Jonathan Majors' legal problems? Alyssa.
It's a little bit of a controversy, but it's, you know, I guess it's good controversy. We don't have like an affirmative answer in this one. It doesn't quite fit the model.
A pos-troversy.
Something
positive
like that.
Controversy. No, that's no good. Peter's making a face. So. Peter.
I mean, I love a portmanteau as much as anybody else, but postroversy, that sounds like something. It sounds like somebody's like mad about dog paws. I don't think that's right. I do think this is a non-troversy. It's just like he bought a movie and released it. You're allowed to do that. And then nobody went to see it. People are allowed to make that choice too. It's just not controversial. Like the original, like the backstory here is in some sense controversial, but the act of buying this movie and putting it out is not controversial.
Controversy. Controversy. This is, but it's an intentional controversy. It's a post-troversy.
Or I guess I should say of acquiring this movie, since it sounds like maybe he didn't actually buy it for any, you know, a meaningful amount of money.
It's a positive atrocity. That's
contrapposto?
Contrapositivity. Anyway, it's a positive
contrapposto is my favorite Italian dish.
It is intentionally a controversial move, and it has worked in the sense that it got us talking about it. So big ups to Mr. Wartenberg and the folks at Briarcliff, you did your work. All right, make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus on Friday for our bonus episode on the digital sweatshops of the nerd culture beat. And now on to the main event. Snow White. It's a new twist on the classic story. Of course, you have the fair maiden Snow White, whose mother and father love her very much. Mom dies. Evil, wicked stepmother comes. She's played by Gal Gadot in this movie and is very mean to Rachel Zegler's Snow White. And of course, there is a mirror, and the evil queen asks the mirror who is the fairest of them all. And Snow White is fine until the mirror says that she's the fairest of them all. But here's a twist. She's not the fairest of them all simply because she is the most beautiful lass in all the land. It's because she's the fairest inside, in her heart. She has the fairness. She's a Peter, how is it described? She's a Brooklyn socialist.
Economic fairness.
Economic fairness. She believes that the people should get pies. The people should get apple pies for the celebration. And if they don't, that's very bad.
There's enough potatoes to go around. Why can't we share some with the bandits who are stealing the potatoes? The reason why you don't is because when people steal your stuff, you don't share it with them. Somebody walks into my house and starts stealing
potatoes. We'll get to you. You can go on your libertarian rant in a moment, Peter. You hold on. You hold your horses. All right.
No potatoes for you, Sonny.
Oh my God, this has gotten dark.
The story here is very classic. Snow White, the huntsman's going to murder Snow White, and she flees to the forest, and she finds the dwarves who are at the mine, and they're doing the fun mine stuff. They're digging some rocks out of the ground. I feel like there was a subplot somewhere that got cut with them having, like, mine gem superpowers at one point. Doc lays his hands on the stones, and they start glowing all around. And they're like, I'm like, this is going to come back to us at some point. And it's never revisited. It's fine. They're just greedy dwarves. They just want all the diamonds in the mine. So anyway, they go to the mine.
Yeah,
they
don't believe in economic fairness. They're mining for themselves.
What is the business model behind the mining? Are they like selling gems to the evil queen? Like, in that case, why don't they just turn over Snow White to keep their deal?
I was actually wondering this myself. I was like, the queen is getting more and more diamonds as the movie goes along that are clearly coming from this gem mine that the dwarves operate. But like, how is she getting them? How are they? Is it a tribute to the queen to be left alone so they can continue to mine their gems with their mind powers? I don't know. They come home, they find Snow White in the house, and Snow White teaches them how to clean their home. She's not whistling while she works. She's whistling while the men learn how to do the chores. It's very important for equity and whatnot. The biggest change probably is that there's no Prince Charming, but there is a charming bandit who teaches her the importance of economic redistribution of the wealth. And it really does, like, I joked about this on Twitter, but this movie is like 20% more entertaining if you imagine it being written by the like dopey communist collective in Hail Caesar. If you remember there's the screenwriters in Hail Caesar, and they have this whole plan for sneaking their messages into the movies, and they're very proud of their dumb little lines. That's what this movie is. This movie is like a parody movie from Hail Caesar. It's a live-action Snow White parody Hail Caesar movie.
This movie is 0% entertaining, so 20% times that is still zero.
I don't understand how math works. All right, anyway, audiences are underwhelmed. It's got a weak B+ from CinemaScore audiences. Similar type movies get in the A to A minus range usually. Did a disappointing $45 million opening weekend. There are so many controversies about this. This is kind of a perfect movie. Sometimes we talk about issues that are scissor issues, right? A scissor is an issue where two sides can both claim to be right in like diametrically opposite ways, and it works with their cohort, their people. And this is very much a scissor movie. You could say, oh, I'm a... Who all was protesting this? You had Zegler was attacking the original film, right? She was saying, well, this, you know, the original one is not nearly feminist enough. It's so outdated, blah, blah, blah. And you could say, oh, the movie failed because she opened her dumb big mouth. But then you also have the racists who are like, well, she's too Hispanic. She can't be Snow White. And they can say, well, we are the reason this movie is failing is because we're not supporting it. And then you have the, you know, the anti-Semites who are mad that the movie stars an Israeli, Gal Gadot. And they can say, oh, the movie failed because we didn't show up. And we pointed out how bad everything is with this. So everybody gets, all the outrage mongers get to take a win here, which is the worst possible outcome for all of us, frankly. But look, the thing is, the movie is not good. It's not a good movie. It is, we'll talk about this in a minute. Peter, I want you in particular to talk about this. The movie is ugly. It's an ugly movie. It's doing this. It's doing the same thing that Wicked did, where you had that weird backlit fake sun with these like awful sepia-toned CGI sets. The whole thing is just awful, ugly, washed out, bad. The CGI dwarves, which, again, that's another community that was outraged. The dwarf community was outraged because they said, you can't have, Peter Dinklage was like, no dwarves, stop stereotyping my people. And then the other dwarves were like, Peter Dinklage, this is the only job that we have. Don't let them take this away from us. So now they're CGI dwarves, and nobody's happy. The songs in the movie are bad songs. Although I do feel like Princess Problems is gonna be played in my household a lot, I think. There's a strong earworm chance there for my daughter. For the record, my 9-year-old daughter enjoyed the movie. She didn't love it, but she enjoyed it. She was entertained the whole time. My 6-year-old son, bored out of his skull, not into Snow White, my 6-year-old. Anyway, I don't know.
Because he's six or because he's a boy?
Both, yes. Alyssa, what did you make of Snow White?
I missed animation so much. I mean, there are many ways to look at this movie, but it's just yet another statement that making things live action or sort of photorealistic, as the case may be, because like obviously a bunch of movies about talking lions are not actually like made by real lions who can speak English. You know, there is a real artistic use case for images that are not realistic. And this is one of them, right? I mean, not least because a lot of the stuff that is, you know, supposedly realistic or whatever looks terrible, right? I mean, Gal Gadot's evil queen literally looks like she kind of went bananas in the like fake gems aisle at a Michael's or like a Joann Fabric, right? Like she just keeps like sticking on more rhinestones at various points in the movie. And like
she stayed up till 1 a.m. watching QVC so that she could get a bedazzler.
The dwarves are at the costume jewelry mine. That's where costume jewelry comes from.
Yes, literally, right? I mean, I have made, like, this stuff literally looks slightly more convincing than the fake gems my daughter likes to, like, stick on her Halloween costumes and periodically on her face. They look so plasticky and stupid. And the sort of very simple hand-drawn animation, you know, that Disney used in its early years would have been just much more visually charming and convincing here, right? Like, the dwarves themselves look like, I don't even know how to describe them, right? They look off in some fundamental way. Like, nothing about this movie is improved by it being live action, right? Like, you know, all the stuff that's like happening in the town square, it just looks like you're watching a show at Disneyland.
Yes.
I just
want to emphasize that.
Yeah.
Like in the way that if you've ever been to a theme park, it looks on the one hand kind of elaborate and expensive. Like it's not quite like a high school play production, but it looks incredibly fake. Like everything is made of paper mache.
Right. Cardboard. And people and like, you know, I'm sorry, but like all of the people in this like tiny fictional medieval kingdom were like get up every day and just like subtly color coordinate their clothing and the fabric that they're wearing, right? Like, there's just the movie ends up being less real and convincing by being live action. It would be much like in terms of wonder and visual beauty, there is literally not a thing I can think of that is sort of an addition here by making it live action. And then it's just silly, right? I mean, Peter and I saw this movie together because the only way I was going to get through this movie was to A, to see it with Peter, and B, to see it in a place where I could have a beer. And the phrase liminal state actually appears in this movie, right? And I turned to Peter
in
just
a
like,
line that is explicitly about how the queen is evil because of her economic policies. And her economic policies kind of justify. Like, it doesn't quite literally say justify. It says it becomes like morally, we enter into a moral liminal state. I don't have the line in front of me, but it is a liminal state between
ethics and survival, right? I mean, just, you know, it feels sort of like a movie created by ChatGPT and Sora to me. Like, it honestly feels like, write me like a woke Snow White movie and like animate it with, and then like animate it in photorealistic style with Sora. I continue to find Rachel
Zegler.
Even
the liberal Alyssa Rosenberg says it's too liberal, this
movie. It's not that it's too, I mean, it's not even effectively liberal, right? I mean, it's in part because it's all fake, right? It's like, let's have a restoration of just like a nicer monarchy, right? Like, it's ugly. It feels just written in a way that's incredibly goofy, right? It just feels, I felt embarrassed watching it. I felt embarrassed for everyone involved. Despite my disagreements with some of her politics and, you know, the badness of this movie, I still find Rachel Zegler just quite a compelling screen presence in general. But I just felt embarrassed for her in this. Everything about it is embarrassing. And Disney should be embarrassed to be doing this, right? I mean, this is not the artistic product of a confident, creatively rich company. And Disney should feel bad looking at a movie like this. I don't know. I don't think either of you have ever read it. But Bill Peet, who was one of the early animators at Disney, wrote, and then later a really excellent children's book artist, he basically did a lot of gremlin work for the studio, wrote a memoir that's in part about just like what a horrible person Walt Disney was. And I just sort of flash back to Bill Peet's memoir and just like, oh man, how would Walt Disney have reacted to this, right? Everyone at Disney should feel bad about this thing.
It is a fascinating, you know, movies take a long time to get made. And this is Peter, I think you mentioned this maybe either in our messages or on Twitter or someplace. But this is a movie that was probably written in 2020 or so and was being produced in 2021. And then there was COVID and strikes and blah, blah, blah. So it's coming out now. But it distinctly
they started hiring key staff, I believe, in 2019, 2020, because it was supposed to shoot during COVID. And then it got delayed. And I believe the bulk of the film, the principal photography, if I understand correctly, was in 2022. And then there were pickups last year in 2024. So this is a movie, most of what you are seeing probably, to the extent that it wasn't rebuilt afterwards, most of what you are seeing was shot in 2022 based on concepts that were initially developed in 2019 and 2020.
And it feels like a movie that was conceptualized in the heady days of 2019 and 2020.
Yeah. And so, I mean, that starts with the kind of key thematic idea, which, as you said, is that they're taking this concept of fairness that is built into the myth, the fairy tale that has always been there and has always represented a kind of beauty or at least a kind of decency, a good-heartedness, right? Like some combination of like personal and intrinsic qualities. And they've decided to make it like literally an about economic fairness, about a kind of Bernie Sanders, Occupy Wall Street, like leftist politics. And I think you could overstate how far it takes that, but it takes it much further than you would expect. This is not merely a children's movie about teaching kindness and about how to share with your fellow villagers and fantasy, you know, town residents. This is very much a movie about how the queen is evil because she won't share, and those are economic policies that have eviscerated the population, and also that more or less morally justifies stealing and makes the bandits the good guys. And I can imagine even a movie that like takes some of that, like that idea and even works well. I mean, that's Robin Hood, right? And there are a bunch of Robin Hoods that I find wonderful. So yes, I'm a libertarian here and I am complaining about a movie that has kind of socialist underpinnings, but it is not the fact that it is socialist that bugs me. It's the fact that it's so dumb about it, that it's so lame, so limp, that this, that the politics have been shoehorned into this movie, not just in an obvious way, but in a kind of cloying and kludgy and annoying way. And that there is nothing else that is pleasurable or enjoyable about this film. The songs are all rotten or boring. I mean, Princess Problems may have an earworm to it, but it's not a very good song. It's literally like a lesson in how Snow White has privilege because, sure, even though she's been condemned to be basically a servant in her own house, she's still a princess, you know, right? And she's being taught this by what amounts to her kind of dirtbag leftist, like, you know, Occupy boyfriend. And it's just, it's so bad on every level and so spectacularly ill-conceived. The thing that it reminds me most in that way, is the most recent Captain America film, which we also talked about. Another movie that was shot a while ago that was long delayed and then had pretty clearly, we know that there were big sequences cut out, there were characters added, it was rebuilt in post. We don't know exactly how different this version of Snow White is from the one that was conceived in 2019 and 2020, but it seems pretty clear to me that there were significant revisions made to the fundamental idea of the film from when it was shot to what we actually got to see. Among other things, there's at least at one point there was some reporting that suggested that the dwarves were supposed to be played by humans initially rather than by CGI characters. And so they rebuilt this in some way that just doesn't make any sense at all. It doesn't work as a sort of as a story or as a visual product. And Sonny, you asked me to talk about the visuals. Alyssa already got to a lot of it. The way that this movie looks, on the one hand, elaborate, like the craftspeople clearly spent a lot of time on this. And there was a bunch of money thrown at elaborate CGI. And a lot of the sets are like either, you know, in addition to being physical sets, there's a lot of computer animated enhancement of the sets. All of it looks awful. Like it makes my shoulders kind of pinch up watching this, right? Like, it's so unpleasant. It's so ugly. And it's not just unpleasant and ugly. It's a betrayal of the source material. Because so much of what made the original 1937 animated Disney Snow White a classic was the beauty, the hand-drawn beauty, and also some of the technical innovations of this being the company's first animated feature. And you go back and you watch that animation, and it's, I don't know whether people will still enjoy it in 1,000 years, but if they have eyes that where they can see things that are like not digital anymore, I feel like they will. This is classic handmade artistic beauty of the kind that endures, of the kind that people love for hundreds of years. And that's such a big part of its reputation and its legacy. And so to go back and to make this movie, which is just cloyingly ugly, aggressively unpleasant to look at. I mean, it's amazing that they like took the idea of fairness and took it away from beauty, because this movie has no beauty. It has nothing that is gorgeous or lovely or sort of or nice or pleasant about it. It's just there because Disney keeps making $1 billion every time they release a live action remake of one of their old animated classics. It doesn't seem like this one is going to make $1 billion. And again, I mean, it's just crazy how bad this movie looks, given that they spent more than $250 million on production. And I kind of know how that happens, but it boggles the mind, especially since think about other fantasy productions that we have seen over the last 25 years. And you think about something like Guillermo del Toro's films, or the Peter Jackson Lord of the Rings trilogy, the first one, not the terrible Hobbit trilogy, which actually did look pretty bad. It's possible to make fantasy films on a medium to large budget, but neither of those, the Del Toro movies are not huge budget films. The Lord of the Rings films were big budget, but smaller comparatively, even I think adjusted for inflation, than what we saw here. I could be wrong on that. You can check my math. But like, they certainly weren't much more expensive than Snow White. And those movies look great. They look the way that fantasy films should look. Yes, they're somewhat more adult, and that means that they can look a little bit darker and a little bit grittier. But it's possible to make really great-looking fantasy films that capture the spirit of classic fantasy art, which is what all of those do. And this I don't know what this is capturing the spirit of. It's capturing the spirit of CGI slop, of just it's crazy that that Hollywood artisans have spent the last 2 years terrified that anybody might ever use AI to generate images, because and then complaining about the quality of those images, and then they give us this, really? Because this looks worse than the crap that Sora spits out.
Yeah, I mean, we need, to return to our theme of economics, we need the market to start working here. We need audiences to start rejecting these things.
It does seem like they kind of are.
Yeah. I don't know if they're rejecting them for the right reasons, but my God, it's, I love going to the movies, but it's a real bummer these stretches when I feel like I mainly love going to the movies so I can talk to you guys about them, not because the movies themselves are transporting. And it's like, there's just something that really brings me down about the part of the year where we've caught up on the last couple of Oscar films from last year. It's like basically to go from the Brutalist to this in a period of a month.
Oh, yeah.
Well, we're about to get to see Jason Statham murder a bunch of sex traffickers.
Working
so.
Man.
The QAnon movie, which we're doing
Call
next
me
week.
The working man.
So exciting.
Boom, 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 boom. All of this is true, and this is depressing. And the market is working, at least until the Lilo and Stitch live action movie comes out, and that makes $1 billion worldwide. Because I gotta tell you, I have two kids, and they're both very excited for that live action Lilo and Stitch movie.
Trying to explain to my son, it's like, so he's like a puppy, but he's an alien.
He's an alien puppy. It's fine. It's nice.
Yes.
He can kind of talk, and he eats a lot of stuff.
He's a very poorly behaved alien puppy.
I have not seen any trailers or anything for that film. But again, that movie, the original, I really liked. And I really liked in part because unless I'm just completely hallucinating, it's been a long time since I've seen it. That was one of the last kind of mostly hand-drawn films that Disney put out.
Yeah, pretty much. All right. So what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on Snow White? Alyssa.
Oh, my God. Can I just sell my thumbs to the bandits in the forest so I don't have to give any thumbs to this movie?
Well, they would just steal your thumbs because they're thieves. Yeah. And you have more than they have.
Take my thumbs, bandits. This movie is terrible.
Peter.
So I'm going to use an AI to generate my hands. And that's obviously going to give me 14 fingers, all of which are thumbs, and they're all down.
Okay. Bad
thumbs
movie.
Down. Bad movie. All right. That's it for today's show. Many thanks to our producer, Rupert Manderstam, without whom this program would sound much worse. Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus on Friday for our bonus episode. Tell your friends. Strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter at Sonny Bunch. I'll convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys on Friday.
You ain't heard about Moto Casino? Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto. I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps. In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free-to-play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino.